Good morning. It's almost 22, the top of the hour. Wouldn't you love to be able to answer all the tough questions and do it well and be a good listener and be inquisitive and know how to get to the root of someone's problems and concerns? We've got J. Warner Wallace on the studio line. Really an amazing thinker and a great author. He's got a new book called Forensic Faith. He is a cold case homicide detective residing in the Los Angeles area. He's been on Dateline and Fox News. I've seen him on both. And he's a former atheist, and he's the author of Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. And now the trilogy is complete with a book called Forensic Faith. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate
it. No, you're just one of my favorites. I saw you present in person about 3 years ago, and I walked out of there, and I thought, okay, that might be one of the best presentations for learning how to share your faith and defend your faith I've ever seen.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you saying that. We're just trying to really kind of think about how each of us can do a better job of that, right? Because a lot of folks don't even know why or can't even imagine why we would need to do it, why we would even need to take time to understand what the evidence is for our faith. But I think it is important in the culture we're in right now.
But your background and as a homicide detective and the way you think and the way you've been trained is such a fascinating application to sharing Christ with others.
Well, it's kind of my own personal journey. Like Lee, you were saying, right? Lee had an experience, which
yeah.
we all now have seen in the movie Case for Christ, and we kind of understand that informs his process then, and that was true for me too. I was 35 before I ever even looked at the Gospels seriously, and by that time I already had a skill set in place as an investigator that was I just couldn't look at it any other way. I almost feel like that was part of my DNA. So I've tried to transfer that to others because after becoming a Christian, I thought, well, isn't this how everyone becomes a Christian?
You know, no.
they examine the Gospels to see if they're reliable, and they use the skill set. And so, yeah, it was probably the only way I could even begin to imagine showing it to others.
And one of the things, Jim, I've been so encouraged by your work is you really do want to help equip people to go out and rely on their training. You can go out and try to share your faith, but if you go out and rely on your training because you've done the work, you're going to be much more effective. I don't know if you're like me, but I was a big fan of the first Rambo movie.
Yeah.
And I remember that one epic scene, and it took about 12 minutes, where he escaped from the sheriff's office, and then he was out in the wilderness, and he dismantled one by one the entire sheriff's department. And I thought, he's relying on his training right now.
Well, I can tell you that it's muscle memory for a lot of us, right?
So absolutely.
We do the same thing over and over and over and over again. So that by the time we're in a crisis situation where maybe we're distracted and we don't have access to be able to focus entirely in a calm situation, well, now we're relying on things we've done so many times that we're just doing them as a matter of a second nature. And if you think about it, most of the time when we're in conversation with people about what we believe, it may be for a lot of us the first time we've ever had that kind of conversation or answered that kind of question. So I found for me that because I'm constantly thinking about these things and I'm having these conversations in my head over and over and over again, by the time I get to a real conversation where somebody's asking those questions, I feel like I've asked and answered them for myself 1,000 times. And then it makes it a little easier for me using muscle memory to respond for somebody else. And so that's why I do think it's important for us to worship God with more than our songs and more than our prayers and more than even our actions. We could worship God with our mind by giving him our thoughts and spending time thinking deeply about, how we, number one, would answer the questions that our friends have, and also just, thinking about the theology of the Christian worldview. And I think that's something that's, in some ways, is missing right now from the equation for many of us as Christians.
Yeah, Jim, now you talk about the difference between accidental and evidential belief. And for a lot of people, they say, well, I believe in God because I was raised in a Christian family. And for a lot of people that you're trying to share faith with, that isn't quite enough. They go, well, a lot of people are raised in certain environments, and if that's why you believe, that doesn't seem good enough. So you talk about the difference between accidental and evidential belief. Say more.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, I started asking people around the country, well, why are you a Christian? Just so I can know where we're starting from. And the answers, I was surprised at the kind of answers I was getting over and over and over again. I got to the point where I could predict for pastors what their congregations were going to say. And it's always in these three categories. You know, number one, I was raised in the church is the most popular answer you're going to get. I was always a Christian. My parents were Christians, and that makes sense, and I can understand that. Two, I've had an experience that confirmed for me that Christianity was true. I prayed for something, or I saw something miraculous. Those are both good answers. And the third I usually get is something like, you know, I used to be a jerk, and I met Jesus, and I'm not so much a jerk anymore. So. That's some act of transformation. But what struck me about those answers is that, you know, although my family is just mostly all atheists, I have my dad remarried and his second wife is Mormon, and he's got six kids with that second wife, and those six kids were all raised LDS. And if you ask them, why are you a Mormon? They give you the same three answers in about the same order. They were really raised this way, of course they were. But they all will say they've had some experience of the Holy Spirit that confirmed for them the Book of Mormon was true. And so these are the kinds of answers that pretty much everyone gives, regardless of what, you know, theistic worldview you hold. And I just thought, you know, should our answers be like everyone else? We don't believe those systems are true, but why do our answers then sound like theirs? Mm-hmm. It seems to me we could do better, given the fact that our worldview is grounded in the event called the resurrection of Jesus. And if that didn't happen, the whole thing is a sham. Mm-hmm. And of course, it did happen. And we could actually talk about it in a way that I think is more than just, well, you know, in my opinion, or I've had this personal subjective experience, or in my upbringing. These are all subjective approaches. And by the way, you know this, as objective truth claims of a culture that is increasingly secular, because they'll make these claims as though their claims are objective. If we respond as though our claims are subjective, well, get ready to surrender your claims. Mm-hmm. Because this, you know, the idea that the desire for to be treated without any discrimination at all runs up against your religious liberties. Your religious liberties are going to cave if people feel like they are grounded not in what's objectively true, but in what is a subjective matter of opinion for you.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you think people can still be a strong Christian if they can't defend in what they believe?
Oh, I think your commitment is another issue altogether. You absolutely can, and I don't think this is a requirement for salvation either, in the sense that mm-hmm. you could be in the right place, but not even know why you're in the right place. You could be there accidentally. You could happen to be in a system that is true, but not really know why it's true. Mm-hmm. And that may be fine in terms of your own where you stand with God yourself. But here's my question: most of us, people who would say, "I don't need this, Jim. I already know it's true, and it is true, so I'm in the right place, and I don't have that desire to know with that kind of precision." Really? Well, I'll bet you there's someone in your family, probably a millennial or a Gen Z, somebody who's a little younger, because that's the group that is leaving the church in record numbers. Mm. And that they are continuing, the attrition rate is terrible. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it will help us, as those folks, for the most part, by the time they're in junior high, had questions, and not about what we believed, mom and dad, but why do you believe it? And they're not going to read Jim Wallace or Lee Strobel or anybody like that. They want to know first and foremost, mom, dad, tell me, why is this true? And when we show over a long period of time that we don't really have the same reasons that their professors seem to offer for why their worldview is true, and by the way, their worldview allows them the freedom to do all kinds of stupid things morally, well, guess what's going to happen? They're going to leave the one worldview that's restricting them mm-hmm. for the worldview that isn't, especially if that worldview seems more reasonable anyway. We need to have a more reasonable evidential faith.
I'm talking to J. Warner Wallace. His latest book, Forensic Faith. We're going to continue our conversation after a short break. It's quarter until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Twelve minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here with you, talking to J. Warner Wallace, his latest book, Forensic Faith. He was a homicide detective. His father was a detective. His son is a detective. Jim, if I were a criminal, who should I fear the most?
I wonder sometimes if my daughter, who's coming up right now, she's in the Marine Corps, is probably the one who will...
She's the tough one, huh?
She becomes a cop. She might be the worst one to fear of all the Wallaces, but for now...
Oh, that's hilarious.
My son Jimmy is still out there doing the job on a daily basis, so he's probably the one we should fear.
Yeah. I was up late last night reading your book. I love the way you think. I love your heart. You don't seem like an author that wants to write books so you can sell and make money. You seem like a guy that genuinely wants to equip people to know how to respond to people to share their faith. I just love the way you work.
Well, and that was part of it for me was that, you know, I came to this late. I became a Christian late, and I felt like I was behind the curve. And when I discovered that people really didn't ever think that there was any connection between, a lot of people don't understand the connection between evidence and what you believe as a Christian, then I thought, well, let me see what I can do. This is the one area that I might be able to participate and contribute something. And, yeah, you're right. I mean, for us, I have a pension. This is all about ministry. We're trying to figure out, well, what has God called us to do in this season? Because I could very easily, my agency still has, we still have several open unsolveds that I started that I could go back, and maybe someday I'll do that, go back and finish, but they're so time-consuming that, but, you know, they would love to have me come back and just work cold cases until I can't, you know, breathe anymore. But mm-hmm. I think it's time for us now to take a turn and talk about, well, how does this approach to deciding? Because remember, every case I've worked had unanswered questions. I mean, every case you go to trial with, there's not a single prosecutor who's ever gone to trial with any case in which there weren't significant unanswered questions that he had to help his jury overcome. Mm-hmm. And we ask jurors all the time, are you the kind of person who can't make a decision unless you have every question answered? If you say, yes, I don't think I can do that, then we're not going to put you on the panel mm-hmm. because we know that we're going to have unanswered questions. So I guess you could make a claim then that in every criminal trial, we make a decision without all the answers. Now, that and sometimes it's called a step of faith,
mm-hmm.
but it's an informed step. It's yes, you're right. We're going to make a step across a void. We can't answer some of these questions, but it's not as though it's blind. We've got good evidence indicating that this is true, even though we don't have every piece of evidence we might like, and until we make a decision. And that's really the kind of faith that Jesus was describing. I mean, he consistently, as a case maker, he consistently said, look, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, at least believe the evidence of these miracles. And he spent 40 days with the disciples after the resurrection, providing them with all the quote-unquote convincing proofs that they would need to be able to make the case when he was gone. And I looked at that and said, you know what, that's a view, that's an approach to thinking that I can accept, because that's what we do in every criminal trial. And here's Jesus 2,000 years earlier doing the same thing with his disciples. I felt very at home in that worldview.
I bet you did. And it's really the collection of evidence that we make decisions based on, because I think a lot of Christians feel intimidated. What if I get a question I can't answer? I'm going to look like a fool. And we don't have to fear that, do we?
Well, when that happens, here's what you do. Well, we all do. The same thing happens in every kind of when a prosecutor says, well, dude, before I file this case, tell me, how do I answer this? Well, I don't know yet. Give me 2 weeks. I'll get back to you, and I'll see what we can find out. I hadn't thought of that. So, okay. So now I spend the next 2 weeks trying to answer that question for the prosecutor so he can be comfortable or she can be comfortable trying the case. Well, the same thing happens with our friends. Yeah, you're going to get questions you can't answer, of course. Thank God for those questions, because guess what? That's going to cause you now to learn something you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to go, now don't think there's not an answer for those questions. There are. You just weren't ready. That's okay. As long as you don't, you know, on the fly say something stupid that's not true, the best thing you can say is, that's a great question. I know there's an answer out there. People have been talking about this stuff for 2,000 years. Let me get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you do. Then you spend time studying.
Yeah, Jim, what do you think about some Christians that they start to investigate and get answers to defend their faith, and they start to feel very challenged, and they start to maybe even lose some of their faith once they start looking for answers to defend it?
Well, this is why, for the most part, you got to be careful when you start. But what do you know? Here's a problem I have, is that when most of us, when we work a case book and as a cold case investigator, we don't do anything until I've read that thing cover to cover two or three times. Then I make a copy of it. So the original sits unmarked on the shelf. I now have a copy, and I start marking up the copy. So I'm so familiar with what the case says before I start that when somebody else comes along later on and says something sideways, I recognize it right away. It's a counterfeit because I know the original so well. Now, that will allow me. So here's the problem I have with most of us. You and I both know that how many times have we or our friends started to read the Bible cover to cover, and we're feeling good about it. You know, we're in Genesis, we're in Exodus, and then we hit Leviticus, and we're like, okay,
done.
You know, let's skip over here now. Before you know it, you've skipped into Proverbs.
Right.
The problem is,
and what a relief.
We haven't spent time learning our case.
Right.
We got to do that first.
I couldn't agree more. And what about, and you make an interesting point in your book about the case that if God's in control, how much do I have to know if he's going to be the one that's going to turn someone's mind? You give a really delightful example of your son ordering a, or you trying to convince him the value of a mushroom pizza. I thought that was just brilliant.
Yeah, that's the only. It's hard, right? Because this balance between God's sovereignty and our free agency is something that no one's really ever satisfactorily resolved, probably as much as we'd like. But here's my lame attempt at doing that. It is all God in the sense that my son for a lot of years would not eat mushrooms. Would not eat mushrooms. So if getting saved required you to voluntarily order a mushroom pizza, he would never get saved because he would never do that because of his hatred of mushrooms. So I can make a case for mushroom pizza till I'm blue in the face. It would have no impact on him. He would not move. Now, if there was a way, though, to remove his enmity of mushrooms, well, then suddenly my case for mushroom pizza might be successful because the first thing I had to do is remove his hatred of mushrooms. I can't do that, but if there's a God that could miraculously remove his enmity, then my efforts become successful. And you might argue, well, okay, so you see now that God's doing something first in softening the heart of my son in this issue. But why even need me at all? Couldn't God go all the way from start to finish? Of course he could. But he's using me, evidentially, to make the case. Why would he do that? Well, because he loves two people in that room. He loves the kid who he just removed the enmity from, and he's saving that kid by drawing him to himself. And that is an act of salvation that is grace, all God's grace, top down. But he also loves me enough to know that in my effort to learn more about him, to study all the evidence, I am becoming closer and closer and more. It's a sanctification process for me. And that's all God, too, because he doesn't need me to do this. He could just turn all of us on with a flip of a switch. So it turns out it's his love of both of us to save one of us and to mature the other that's occurring in that room. It's all God from the start to finish. But he is using us as the means by which we can reach a lost world. And if we do it in this way, I think we are well within the rich, robust, evidential history of Christianity.
You know, Jim, that was just a great illustration that really stuck in my head. And it excited me to be reminding myself that I need to pray that God will in a sovereign way lift the enmity that is in a person's spirit so that I can show up and be an effective case maker in this process. So that was really encouraging. So thank you for this great book, Forensic Faith. I love you, Jay Warner Wallace. You're one of the people I really look forward to your work and your testimony and all you're doing. So thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show. I so appreciate you.
You bet. Thanks so much. All right, a couple minutes until the top of the hour, and I just can't say enough about Forensic Faith. And Jay Warner Wallace is the author of Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. It's a great book.